Interview.
1 Interview du jour.
À l'écoute de Radio Diwa sur le 107.5 en modulation de fréquence, aujourd'hui, amis auditeurs et auditrices, réflexion sur un problème qui ne nous concerne absolument pas à la radio. Quoique, nous écoutez-vous sur Internet ? La culture de l'écran, 48 minutes. Comment notre cerveau, notre façon de faire société, sont changés par cette nouvelle donnée culturelle. Un programme non francophone, entièrement en anglais, réalisé par James Tomlin pour Jordan Brown, réalisateur vidéo, musicien et activiste, dont le site internet vaut le détour, jore.cc. Un programme aujourd'hui donc qui consiste en un entretien avec Suzanne Greenfield, spécialiste de la physiologie du cerveau, dont les recherches portent sur l'impact des technologies du XXIe siècle sur l'esprit. L'intégralité de l'interview est retranscrite sur le site de la radio rdwa.fr. Bonne écoute.
Susan, can you please outline and explain what screen culture is?
Screen culture is, for me, as its name suggests, a whole way of life revolving around the digital devices. So when we say screen culture, whilst I wouldn't exclude television, it's more the interactive nature and the mobile nature of digital devices, which of course can embrace interactive TV nowadays. But it's more specifically when you think about the amount of hours people spend either with their Xbox or their laptop, or indeed their mobiles, or perhaps even nowadays with Google Glass.
Could you take us through the concept of plasticity and what that means for a mind immersed in a pervasive screen environment? How many thinking about something has a similar effect on the brain as actually doing that something? For example, the piano experiment and the muscle.
Yeah, that's way too much.
It's too much.
Yeah, just start with the first one.
Yeah. Could you take us through the concept of plasticity and what it means for a mind immersed in a screen environment?
As a neuroscientist, the reason I'm particularly fascinated, and I think in equal measure both excited and alarmed by the impact of screen culture on the human brain, is because, as a neuroscientist, I know that the human brain is changing. It's highly plastic, as we say. That's not to mean it's made of plastic, of course, but more that it's very dynamic. It will adapt to the environment. We've got the evolutionary mandate, more than any other species, to occupy more ecological niches than any other on the planet because of this wonderful ability that other brains have, but our species has it superlatively, to adapt to the environment. So this is what was meant by plasticity. And one example, for example, a very famous one, is of piano players, where they had three groups of adult human volunteers, none of whom could play the piano. And even over 5 days, you could see that whereas the controls, who were just staring at the piano, showed no change in their brains, the brains were literally unimpressed, those people who were taught five-finger piano exercises showed an astonishing change in brain territory and functional area relating to digits, even over 5 days. But the even more exciting group were the third people who just imagined they were playing the piano. And astonishingly, their brains showed the similar changes to those that had done the physical exercise. So I think this shows you how everything you do, even a mere thought, in inverted commas, will literally leave its mark on your brain. And therefore, if that is the case, if we are so sensitive in adapting to the environment, if the environment is changing in an unprecedented way, as I argue as it is with the cyber world, then it follows that the brain will change in a similarly unprecedented way.
Great. Can you take us through identity and how screen culture might be redefining or changing?
Of the many issues that...
Do it one more time. My voice was still doing my thing. Could you take us through identity and how screen culture may be redefining or changing it?
Of the many issues that I think arise in what I call mind change, that is to say the impact of screen culture on our lives, I think the issue of identity is one of the most important ones. More specifically, the impact of social networking sites. We have to first think of what identity is in any event. And of course, this is a very complex question and issue. For me, identity goes beyond merely having a mind. We have the two words after all. And whilst on a desert island, for example, you wouldn't, at least at the beginning, lose your mind. You'd still be you. You'd still interpret the world in certain ways. Would you have an identity on a desert island? And I'd like to think that identity arises always from interaction and from a particular context with others. So you might have an identity normally as a father or as a son or as the boss or as the employee or as the goalie or as the other member of the choir. And according to the context in which you are at any particular moment, that will be the dominant identity that you are experiencing. And I think that, up until now at least, all these different contexts, these different scenarios, are subsumed in a sort of narrative that gives you an overarching, generalized sense of being you and of being the person you are, whether it's being a father or a son or a team player or a singer or the boss. Nonetheless, they're all aspects of you, and they are this greater idea is of you. Now, this requires a very robust inner infrastructure. It requires a very robust set of connectivity in the brain that has access to memories, that has personalized experiences that make you the unique individual that you are. And nonetheless, although you are influenced and interacting with the outside world, there's this enduring sense that you're still you. Your boss can shout at you, but you'll still be you. You can fall in love, but you'll still be you. You can have a really good game of football, but you're still you. Because there's this inner sense of robust identity, irrespective of the immediate ongoing thing that you're doing. Now, what I'm concerned about is with social networking sites, you are encouraged to construct your identity externally. That is to say, instead of internalizing this robust private life that is you, now everything on an almost momentary basis is subject to the approval and the judgment and the evaluations of others. And these others are not so much friends, but more an audience. And if you're doing that, if you are constantly out there where everything you're thinking or feeling is subject to the audience, then I think it might be more fragile, more vulnerable, more changeable than it will be if it's internalized.
So do you see perhaps an erosion of a robust identity in the world of the screens?
So this would mean that for those people who are devotees of social networking, and I want to exclude people perhaps who've gone to Australia from the UK and are keeping up with their friends on their social networking sites, but where the communication is based on an erstwhile friendship, leaving that kind of relationship aside, the sort of relationship where you have X hundred friends whom you've never met, that is where the concern comes in. Indeed, there's lots of data out there now showing that there is an increase in narcissism, but sadly coupled with low self-esteem also, because the more you seek approval from others, the more you'll idealise yourself. The more you idealise yourself, the more you depart from the real you. So the lonelier you will feel, the more you will go onto social networking sites. But because in order to appease and get the approval of this vast audience of hundreds of so-called friends, you're not going to be the real you. And I think the other thing that I fear is that normally when you are friends with someone, when you have an identity in relation to other people, that's because you're looking someone in the eye, you're perhaps touching them on the arm or wherever, according to the sort of relationship you have. You're registering their voice tone. If they look away, if they fold their arms, that will restrain you for a little while when you first meet someone to sort of hold back a bit. So you won't self-disclose everything, because evolution and biology has introduced body language to enable you to have the safeguards not to disclose everything to everyone, because if you do that, you'll be very vulnerable. They might take you over. So this means you'll use body language to calibrate how close you can get to someone, when you'll get close to someone, how much you disclose to someone. Now imagine a scenario, the screen scenario, where that constraint is removed because you're not using eye contact, you're not using body language, you're not using voice tone, you're not touching someone. So now you'll just self-disclose, because that's a fun thing to do. It combats loneliness. But by so doing, you'll let more out, and it will be perhaps not real, because you want to impress someone and so on. These endless audience that are endlessly voraciously waiting to put their thumbs up or down according to what you're doing. And that will give a vicious cycle that you'll feel lonelier, you'll feel less secure, and therefore you'll seek approval even more. And that's where I think there is a shift. it's a quantitative shift, not a qualitative one, whereas identity before was something that was reasonably robust and internalized. Now it's fragile and externalized.
Are you okay with that curtain going? Further, speaking about identity in the context of consumerism and individualism, can you please explain for us what you've dubbed as the someone, the anyone, and the nobody, and how screen culture provides this opportunity to be a nobody on a scale like we've not ever seen before?
If one looks away from the screen for the moment and thinks about identity more generally and the impact of culture and civilization on the options people have to express themselves, let's go back to the 20th century. I think that there were two very dominant options there. One was what I call the somebody option, and that is where you are literally a somebody. You are defined by what you own. Now, what's very interesting is this goes back even further to the 1920s with the nephew of Freud, someone called Bernays. Bernays had a tricky problem. He was in advertising, and he wanted to get people to buy things they didn't need. Because this was the start, if you like, of capitalism after the First World War. And one particular example, and I think a telling one, was to try and get women to smoke, because clearly there was a vast market there to sell cigarettes to half the population that weren't buying them. And instead of saying, oh, smoking's great, it makes you feel good, and so on, he had a much cleverer plan. What he had was beautiful young girls holding cigarettes, and the slogan was, the torch of freedom. What Bernays had done, and this is in advertising still today, is to imply that by doing something or owning something, it will say something about you. It will say that you are, in this case, liberated and free and modern or whatever. And you can look on the web nowadays and there's still the slogan, as individual as you are, or the product that says something about you. And that can apply to fluffy toys, to kitchens, to clothes, to everything. It's something that in our consumer world, in our capitalist world, is a means of expressing our identity. And as Oliver James, a British psychologist, brilliantly wrote in a book called Affluenza, amazingly, guess what, it doesn't bring happiness, because you get the trainers that are as individual as you are that say something about you, and guess what, your neighbour has the same, and you enter into this arms race where you are out competing to try and be a somebody. We talk about being a somebody and someone, yeah. And I think that this is an option where you perhaps are individual, but you're never fulfilled. Now, the other option that dominated in the 20th century was what I call the anyone scenario. And this is dominant both in fascism, in communism, and in any ideology, whether it's political or religious, where the individual is subsumed under a collective, where what is really important is the narrative of the ideology of the movement. Now, and that's still dominant, of course, today in certain fundamentalist organisations. Now, the problem there is you might be fulfilled, you're in some great narrative that has a noble cause, whatever that might be, but you're no longer individual, to the extreme example that you might be expected to sacrifice your own life in favour of the greater cause. So, of course, the anyone scenario isn't that attractive either for most of us as an option. So that's anyone and that's someone. There's also, and this had possibilities of expression in the 20th century, but I think now has been amplified by screen culture, of being nobody. By being nobody, I mean you literally let yourself go. You blow your mind. You lose your mind. Now, of course, human beings have always done this. We've always had wine, women and song, incarnated as drugs and sex and rock and roll, where we choose to put ourselves in environments where we're no longer ourselves. We've let ourselves go. We've blown our mind. That's so personal to us. We're having a sensational time. No one wants to go out and have a cognitive time, but you go out and have a sensational time. It's where the senses dominate. So let's take dancing or drinking or sex. In all those examples, you are not self-conscious. You are conscious, but you're not self-conscious. And it's always fascinated me that humanity has always had this other mode that from time to time we've wanted to do, where we've abrogated our sense of self and we pay money to do this. Now, what interests me a lot is I think for the first time, video games in particular, but screen culture generally, is giving people this opportunity to abrogate the sense of self and to blow their minds and to have, at a premium, strong sensations rather than a notion of a personal narrative. It's a time where you're just experiencing in a sort of yuck and wow way. And one example of that was when I was saying this to a journalist a year or two ago, and I said, are we going to live in a society of yuck and wow, where people just either say yuck or wow and just reacting in that monosyllabic way. And because I talk fast, she mistyped it as Yakawow. And I was astonished that within 24 hours it went viral. And I think it was attractive, and people were selling T-shirts. Sadly, they'd taken out the domain name, saying, "Welcome to the world of Yakawa, a world, a breezy world for no consequences." And the whole notion of it and why it was attractive as this silly word was it, you know, the first church of Yakawa welcomes you to no consequences. And I think that that has an appeal that is exaggerated beyond the normal cultures and societies that we've witnessed in the previous century.
Great. We've done a page. So I think
how are we for time?
Speed up.
Okay. Yeah. About halfway through.
Probably just a little less context, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So
shorter answers.
Shorter answers, yeah.
Okay.
We have to get this down. That's a good, you know, introduction. We've got really solid.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Start rattling through it now. As human beings, we've got a desire to connect and have meaningful relationships with each other. Could these things perhaps be the drivers and the reasons that we turn and return to the screen?
Yes, I think people return and turn to the screen because, unlike in real life, you inevitably will get instant feedback. You'll get someone writing into you, and irrespective of the time or place that you are, you'll always have someone there who'll comment on you. Is that too short?
Yeah, I think he wants, yeah, maybe a little bit longer. So perhaps something about the obsession of checking Facebook for updates.
I think certainly the obsession with checking for text messages or Facebook for upgrades is it fulfills. It's almost like scratch cards. You're getting a little bit of excitement, but it's never enough, and there's always the possibility of another. And you don't quite know when it's going to be. Now, we know that that's just the situation in the brain that precipitates the release of a chemical called dopamine, which is related to addiction and reward.
Great. Do you think that screen culture, as it is today, exacerbates insular or introspective traits in people?
Okay, someone might say that screen culture exacerbates introspective traits in people. I don't see how they would reason that because it's so immediate and it's so multi-sensory. I don't know why people say that because it's so fast.
Say it one more time. I don't know why people say that.
Yeah, okay. I don't know why people... And as some have, say that perhaps the screen culture is encouraging introspection. I think probably quite the opposite. If you're in a world where what you see is what you get, where everything is reduced to simplified symbols or simplified statements, even the very word YOLO, you only live once, which is apparently put at the end of statements that you make, where you show and tell, where you just download the chocolate cake that you're about to eat without saying anything about the chocolate cake, this isn't encouraging introspection or an individualization. This is just being in the here and now, reacting to things as they happen. And therefore, I think perhaps the opposite. It will discourage people to reflect and have the time to think about who they are.
Should we go into a bit more detail about the addiction, about dopamine?
Mm-hmm.
Because you picked it up mm-hmm. on the previous question. Mm-hmm. Just before we do that... So he says, perhaps we can look at how the best sense of self, thin waistline, the dragon slayer, instead of an accountant in Second Life, how can you edit and revise communications and email, unlike in real life, and therefore how people with autistic spectrum disorders are very comfortable in Second Life, is that mm-hmm. true?
They are. Mm.
Yeah.
Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, just quickly.
Very quickly, if we think that with social networking sites, perhaps you're not rehearsing body language. If you're not rehearsing body language, then you're not very good at reading the signs that most of us use in face-to-face conversation to establish empathy, which goes beyond words. It's being able to interpret the body language and the voice tone. Now, what's very interesting is people with autistic spectrum disorder have problems with empathy. They fail, and they have great impairment to interpret just by interacting with someone how they might be feeling. Now, what's very interesting is people with autistic spectrum disorder are particularly comfortable in the cyber world. And my own view is that that is because in the cyber world, we are all in the same position. The playing field has been leveled. That is to say, we are not using either all the tricks of body language to interpret how someone else might be feeling, which is why for autistic people, to live in a world where what you see is what you get and where actions speak louder than words is probably a more comfortable place. Than it would be in the real world, where you're aware that people are picking up on something that you yourself are not. Moreover, To go further, and this is highly controversial, but I think something that's worth reflecting on, is whether or not people that are compulsively interacting with the screen might develop themselves autistic type, and I say autistic type, not clinically autistic, autistic type traits. And one example of that is a study where they were recording the EEG from people when they showed them a face as opposed to a table. Now, in people that are not autistic, in adults, when people see a face, the EEG is a more marked response than when they see an object like a table. And for autistic people, the EEG is the same. They don't differentiate between a face and a table in terms of excitement or importance. Guess what? People that are spending a lot of time on the internet, their EEG doesn't differentiate between the face and the table. So I think clearly this is an area that must be explored, but it does follow, it would make sense for me, that if you're not rehearsing empathy, you're not going to be very good at it. And therefore there might be these consequences of not being so good at interpersonal interaction.
Can we just briefly backtrack on addiction? Let's talk about how
that... For one second.
Can we just talk briefly about the idea of addiction for the moment?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, what do you want to say?
Essentially, you know, if you... With regards to screen technologies, how does the experience of the moment trump future consequences?
Yeah, I think that when you're playing video games, for example... one of the ideas, one of the tenets of video game design is that there shouldn't be long-term consequences. And what concerns me there is that if you're living in a world where people can be obligingly undead the next time around, this is not a particularly good lesson to learn about life. It might make you more reckless, certainly. But at the same time, you don't have a sense of enduring long-term meaning or significance, because if everything is reversible, it's not significant or meaningful. If I drop a piece of paper on the floor and pick it up again, that's not very meaningful because I've reversed it. If I punch someone in the face and their teeth fall out, that is highly meaningful because it's irreversible. They'll never have their teeth again. Now, what's very interesting about that world, that exciting world where you are aroused and you're in the moment, is we know that that's a good condition within the brain to release the chemical dopamine. And we know that dopamine is a very useful transmitter in the brain, chemical messenger. It mediates things like movement, and it's in excess in schizophrenia, but among its many jobs, one of the things it seems to participate in is reward systems, but also addiction. Every drug of addiction, every drug, irrespective of its chemical status and its immediate target, every drug of addiction will cause the release of dopamine in the brain. So we know that if there's lots of dopamine being released in the brain, then that could tie in with feelings of reward and also possibly addiction. Now, one has to be careful because addiction has very narrow definitions, or you can use words like compulsive. But now the American Psychiatric Association has got it on its list to be considered, internet addiction, as a condition, as a psychiatric condition. And numbers vary around the world, but there are estimates that roughly about 10% would be what would be called addictive, for what that's worth.
So exploring the concept of process over content in the context of screen culture, what do you mean by process over content?
I've often spoken about the benefits of screen culture being one of agile processing, but how that mustn't be confused with content. Now, there's a book written a while ago now by someone called Stephen Johnson called Everything Bad is Good for You, which extolled the benefits of screen culture. And one of them is that it could be linked to high IQ, because the skills that you rehearse when you play video games are similar to those that are acquired to do well in IQ tests. That's to say, you don't need a lot of facts or infrastructure or hinterland, but you do have to be very agile at looking at patterns and connections and getting to an answer in a rather fast time frame. So the idea is that because the human brain is always good at what it rehearses, if you're rehearsing that, you're going to be good at it. And so then you go to an IQ test and guess what? You'll be good. But even Stephen Johnson says, just because, as many claim, we're seeing an increase in IQ scores in certain societies, we're not seeing an increase in empathy or understanding or creativity or insight, and we're not seeing an increase in brilliant novels being written or insights into the economic woes of the world or the Middle East crisis. You know, no one suddenly come up with their superior cognitive abilities with insights that we would regard as important. Now, I think what you need to do, therefore, is on the one hand, yes, it's very good for mental processing, for what used to be called fluid intelligence. That's to say, where the emphasis is on giving a right response to an input. My own little brother, for example, when he was 3 and I was 16, I used to force him to learn Shakespeare. He could recite off in a way that an adult perhaps wouldn't have done so efficiently great swathes of Shakespeare because he'd learned it by heart, and I taught him. He was like a parrot. So we know that processing fluid intelligence might be linked to rehearsals with those kind of activities on the screen. But that's not the same as understanding. Information is not knowledge, and I think this is what people confuse. And by knowledge, I refer to content. And content, for me, is true intelligence, which is where you can see one thing in terms of another. So, for example, the bit in Macbeth, out, out, brief candle. In order to really understand that, you have to see the analogy between the extinction of the candle and the extinction of life. You can't just say, take a candle literally. And I think that that's what we are missing out on. That's what might be in jeopardy. That's certainly not enhanced by doing very fast, clever things with video games, even though you might be able to give impressive responses very quickly, correct responses very quickly. That's not the same as understanding, and I think we have to be careful about differentiating them.
Could you just talk a little bit about the aspects of learning versus simply accessing facts, contrasting it with building knowledge and understanding?
So following on from that idea, we think about learning. And let's take the example of the British Education Minister, Michael Gove, who recently said, yes, young children now, everyone should learn a poem. And I think that's wrong. I think the emphasis should be they should understand the poem, because of course a child can be a parrot, as my little brother was. So really what we need is not just to access facts, but we need to see one fact in terms of something else. So facts on their own are pretty boring. You know, who cares the height of a mountain or the date of a battle or the name of a king? These things are only relevant if you relate them to others and you see a trend and you can generalise. Or if you're learning the name of a king, you know more about that king and why he was important. So a fact on its own, which is why Trivial Pursuits and pub quizzes are not held up as the pinnacle of intellectual achievement, facts on their own are not the same as interpreting the facts, putting the facts into a framework, and even more important than facts are ideas, and you do not get automatically ideas coming out of an iPad. You won't have that. You'll have access to facts, but it requires an inspired teacher, requires your thinking processes, it requires something in addition for you personally to join up the dots, and that's for me, real knowledge.
So just amplifying that, if we talk about the notion of not so much internalising and understanding the facts, because you can actually just go to Google and look.
Recently there was some work done by someone called Sparrow, where she claimed that we were changing our memory processing because you can just look something up on Google. And what she found was that people remembered very well where to access things, but not the facts themselves. And that does concern me, because let's take that ad absurdum. If you feel you can look anything up and you don't have to learn anything, this would mean conversation is going to be pretty clunky, because if I normally meet someone of roughly my generation and culture, I will assume they know where Barcelona is. I'll assume they know who Napoleon was or who Henry VIII was. I'll assume they know where New York is. So you can have a conversation. And we all know the delight of having conversations with people where you share a lot of background knowledge that can develop ideas. But imagine having a conversation with someone who knew nothing, who didn't know who Hitler was, who hadn't heard of fascism, who had to look it up each time. This would mean that you couldn't really have a very fluid or interactive conversation. And I know that sounds extreme, but if we are always having recourse to an external source of memory, then I think it's going to have a severe impact on how we interact, how fast we have ideas, and what we do with them. And I think that the younger generation perhaps might be disadvantaged in not having such ready agile processes and have a much more cut and paste mentality to what they're learning.
He wants to talk about manipulation. Does he mean he says information can be coloured by augmented reality.
Oh, augmented reality I can talk about.
Yeah. So what the gist of this one is...
It's Google Glass, presumably, yeah.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. But the prospect of manipulation, does he mean manipulating facts, or does he mean manipulating...
People? Let's try. Yeah.
Okay.
One of the most alarming and, I think, insidious developments, which people haven't really talked about a lot, is the advent of Google Glass, which hasn't really taken off yet, but I gather it's going to hit the mass market towards the end of 2013, end of this year. And I'm sure most people know this, but anyway, it's where you wear these rimless glasses with a funny black oblong device in one corner, which, of course, will augment reality for you. So as you're going around, you'll know more than your five senses are telling you. This sounds a fantastic thing, But imagine living in a world that is unremittingly giving you additional information all the time, and you don't have time to digest it or do anything with it because you're on to the next new thing that's coming along. Moreover, it can give a readout of where you are and what you're thinking. So it's like a constant Facebook or a constant Twitter feed where all the time you are interactive, you're plugged in, you're hyper-connected to everyone else. And I think that this may make people more vulnerable. First of all, it will become compulsive, and that not having it, you'll suddenly feel that you've lost a sense or you've lost something, you're at some disadvantage. So I predict that once these things become on the mass market, it'll be like mobile phones. Everyone will have to have one and have one, and it will change the culture. But in a way that is passive, that is to say, with a mobile phone, at least you have to access the thing. You have to take it out your pocket. You have to press the screen or you have to do something. Here, you won't have to do anything. You'll just be walking around, and there it will be, this augmented reality all the time. And it also means that perhaps you could be manipulated yourself according to the feed that you're giving, according to where you are and what you're doing. Perhaps even more than is the case at the moment with Google, things can be tailored to be put in. We now know that when you go shopping or online, your tastes are logged so that that can be personalised for you in a bespoke way. So imagine that amplified even more, where everything you've done is going into some horrible, vast Big Brother database where you can then be manipulated, it can be accessed. I don't think people have realised just how pervasive Google Glass is going to be once it really takes off, but it's something that for ethical reasons concerns me, for as a neuroscientist it concerns me, because I think it's the final last barricade of privacy that will be stormed. And at the same time, I can see people finding it so alluring and so exciting that they won't want to use it intermittently.
Can we just talk a little bit about, we're able to Google things when we need the information at hand. How does this affect the deep thinking that people have about something?
Yeah, even now, I think when you Google something, it really has changed the tables, turned the tables around. In the old days, I remember as a student, I lived in a answer-rich, sorry, I remember as a student, I lived in a question-rich, answer-poor world. That is to say, in order to find something out, I'd have to go to the library, I would have to forage around the books, perhaps some other student had taken out that book, I'd have to wait, I'd have to order it out from the stack. I had to work very hard to get access to certain facts and to certain information. But nonetheless, I had the time, therefore, to know exactly what I wanted to know, to formulate a very crisp question, to know exactly what would satisfy me or not, comparing it with other answers. Now we're living in a world where we are bombarded with answers. And we're so bombarded with answers, I don't think we have time to formulate questions anymore. And we are so perhaps transported by the experience of accessing Google and of surfing and of watching YouTube, most of which has no real significance. Watching a dog as a trick cyclist is so what? You know, watching people planking, watching the Harlem Shake. Why are we doing this? It's because the experience of it is obviously, by definition, pleasurable. But we're not doing it to find anything out. We're not on a quest anymore because we know we can go on to the next thing and the next thing. And this, in a sense, the means has outpaced the ends. And I think that, again, this will have serious implications for education.
Can you talk a little bit about distraction and short attention spans? Mm. How the screen environment mandates that you have a short attention span.
So, of course, one asks, why does the screen environment, why is it so appealing compared to the real world? Because, after all, it's only stimulating your hearing and your vision. It's two dimensions. Why should that be more attractive than climbing a tree or feeling the sun on your face or the wind in your hair or the smell of the ocean? Why should it be better than that? And I think the answer is because it's fast and furious, because the experiences are suprasensory. You only have to look at modern video games to see how fast and bright and loud and fast-paced and exhilarating and arousing they are for many people. Now, the price you pay for that super sensory stimulation, is that because it's so fast, you, as a human being, as always obligingly adapting to your environment, will adapt to an environment that mandates a short attention span. And I think that the increase in prescriptions for methylphenidate, the most common example, Ritalin, should make us think about whether there's a link with attentional disorders and, in particular, video games, but screen culture.
If the truck went past, if we just talk about the prescribing again.
OK, if we look and see how methylphenidate prescriptions have soared, that's Ritalin, and drugs that are prescribed for attentional problems. That's sought. Now, it could be that the drugs are being given more liberally. It could be that ADHD has been medicalized in a way it wasn't before. Or it could just be that if you take a young brain with the evolutionary mandate to adapt to the environment, and the environment is a fast-paced one, you'll adapt to that. Of course, that's what you do. And then you'll go to school and you'll fidget a bit and someone will say you have an attentional problem. Now, we know that there is a link with this, because what's really interesting is people are suggesting a bi-directional causality between, in particular, video games and attention. It turns out that people that play video games a lot have a history of attentional issues and vice versa. And it could be that when you play a video game and you're releasing this dopamine in the brain, in a way that's simulating what Ritalin does, which is to release dopamine in the brain. Yeah. So it could be almost that kids, perhaps, who have this mindset are self-medicating when they play video games, almost.
Can you just talk a little bit about how screen experiences are literal? They're a sensational time. How does that contrast with other forms of interaction or brain processes?
Now, of course, with screens, they stimulate only hearing and vision, but they have to do that, which means that, leaving aside issues such as Kindle and reading from the screen, and I'm happy to talk about that later, on the whole, especially for younger people, much of their screen experiences is very visual. It's not just words. And I think if you are encouraged always to traffic in symbols and icons and vision, then that is how your world will be. It will be a very literal world where things don't have a significance or a meaning. What you see is what you get. So let's take something like, I think this example, a princess in a video game. When you play the video game to rescue the princess, she's an icon. She doesn't mean anything. She's just there. She's the thing that you rescue. Whereas when you read about a princess in a novel, the princess has a past like you. She has relationships like you. She has a future, hopefully, like you, hopefully. She has, therefore, a meaning and a significance, which is the reason why you keep turning the pages. You want to find out what happens to the princess. So she has an identity and a significance in a way, because she's this abstract persona in that you can't see, but you can imagine. She has a significance that's much more significant and important than this icon in the video game who literally means nothing. And I think that if you're always trafficking icons that have no significance, there's no context, there's no relevance, they're just there, then the world will just be there. It'll be like a child's world. You know how for small children, the world is a literal one. And as soon as someone goes away, they're no longer there anymore. And you look at the next thing, you look at the ice cream, or you look at the bird, or you're onto the next immediate thing in your environment. You haven't been able to internalize anything because you're still at a very early stage in your development where you're just reacting as animals do to your immediate environment. And I fear that if people give young people especially an environment where you're reacting to an external visual literal input, then we might be denying them what until now has been the birthright of humans when they read books, which is the ability to have a longer attention span and, above all, imagination.
So we basically answered the learning education question, haven't we? What does literalism mean for learning education?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, yeah. How are we for time?
Yeah.
Well, about 10 minutes. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So where screen interaction is literal, what are some of the impacts specifically on communication?
So I think that when people are literally rescuing the princess, or playing a fast-paced first-person shooter game, or even adopting an avatar persona with the internet video games where you're playing with a lot of other people continuously. This is, in a sense, taking you into a different world than the real messy world where there's the real you, where actions do have consequences, where things don't cooperate, things don't feedback immediately. And this world, which is much more complex and messy and less satisfactory than the bright, fast, immediate world where you are important and special and anyway things don't matter when you do them. That's a very different world, and I think it's the world very much of the children. You know, what really gets me about video games is it's always intergalactic warfare or princesses or demons or fairy tales almost, of a level that normally only a small child would read about rather than the real world. And I think that by living in this world of magic and superhuman properties, one's overlooking what really makes a person a person. I mean, I can't ever imagine, for example, Pride and Prejudice is a video game, for example. It would never happen. Yeah. So, or King Lear is a video game. No, of course not. So what I worry about is this simplified world, which is fast, and you can give cosmetically and superficially the impression you're being very agile and clever by giving responses. But actually, are you not now missing out on the sort of things that previous generations have gained from King Lear and Jane Austen?
Does this also mean that there's a decline in empathy as well?
I would also predict that, therefore, if you're not rehearsing the skills that has been your biological mandate, you want to have a very small child will just stare at you. They don't automatically have interpersonal skills. These are things you learn as you play with kids. You learn to interpret body language, eye contact, voice tone. If you're not rehearsing those things, how can you be good at them?
Don't you think your approach is Luddite? Technology's always been around. It doesn't, technological yeah. process always mean that things get better. Mm.
Some people have obviously, inevitably, if you have any idea, people are going to criticise you, and that's healthy and it's appropriate and it's good. So one of the ones that have been lodged against me is that I'm just some old baby boomer and technology's always been there. Look at the printing press and look at the television and so on. So let's have a think about that, because I'm sufficiently ancient to remember the advent of the television, which came on at 6 in the evening or thereabouts, or 5. It went off at 11 o'clock. There were two channels. But most importantly, the whole family would gather around one TV set. The TV was much more like the piano in Victorian times. It was the catalyst for family interaction, family discussion. It was part of a family activity. It wasn't something you did in isolation in your bedroom. So when one talks about, for example, the TV, it was used in a very, very different way. It's how it's used. And similarly, when you think of other technologies, like the printing press, like the car, like the refrigerator, they've all been means to an end. They've been a means to an end. Books give you insights for real life, whether it's fact or fiction that you're reading, that give you information and insights into how other people think and feel. Moreover, very few people read books all day continuously, whereas with the screen technologies, people can be up to 10 hours a day. In theory, you could wake up in the morning, do your emails, go dating, go shopping, learn things, go surfing. Everything could be done, short of actually eating food and going to the loo. Short of those two biological needs, you could spend your entire life living in parallel, doing the things that people do in the real world, but online. Yeah. So this, for me, is very different. And whereas technology in the past was a means to an end, now it's an end in of itself. And that's where I worry. And obviously people will personally attack you, rather like in the 50s they attacked the people that dared to say that smoking might be linked to cancer. Because if people are having fun and other people are making money out of them, the last thing you want to spoil this happy relationship is someone saying, well, actually, is this right? Is there not a problem here? And I think that we shouldn't be complacent and assume that everything is just fine. We should question and think about it. And if in the end it turns out that it is all fantastic, then so be it. But we have to have the debate first.
How does screen culture shake up our concept of space and time?
Now, what's very interesting is, as we live our lives up until now, space and time have been the great coordinates by which everything is measured, everything is done. We have episodes at a certain time in our lives that occurred in a certain place in our lives, and the linking of these very specific episodes in space and time, especially for humans, is, if you like, our whole construct of reality. We know that very small children, and indeed animals, don't have this very strong memory for very specific episodes. And we know that if you damage the frontal part of the brain, which is underdeveloped in children, you get something called source amnesia, which is you can have generic memories, but you can't place them in space or time. Now, my own concern is that if we're in the screen culture, of course, you can go online anytime. There'll always be people answering you. And space has shriveled. I mean, it doesn't exist anymore. You can talk to someone in Australia at any time of the day. So this means the normal constraints of having an episode in your life that was defined by being a certain time of day or being in a certain place are no longer there. Cyberspace, where is cyberspace? It's something where you're just out there. And I think that whilst in moderation, that's fine, if that becomes the default condition, then it might make you a little bit more like, dare I say it, the infant or the non-human, where you're living in a generic world that you don't anchor in specific episodes in your life, because it's all a kind of cyber fuzz. Yeah.
We've got 5 minutes left, okay? Mm-hmm. Two more questions. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the question is, where do you see the development of technology headed? But he's interested in transhumanism.
Okay. Of course, the interesting and important question we should ask is, where is this cyberculture headed? I think we have to put it into a wider context. I mean, even the geekiest will have illnesses, get old, eventually die. And what I find interesting, if we look at biotechnology, how that now is transcending the generations in terms of what we look like, how long and healthy we're going to live for, and even eventually reproduction. We can all reproduce for longer now, and perhaps eventually everyone of any age will be able to have a child of any sexual orientation with genetic material extracted from any cell in their bodies. So I think there are some science fiction type scenarios just around the corner, beyond the screen technologies, similarly with nanotechnology, where we can have smart devices within our bodies that perhaps breach the firewall previously that differentiated you from the outside world. So I think that those technologies should be viewed hand in hand with information technology. Now, what's very interesting is so-called transhumanism. The more ambitious we become with manipulating small sensing devices or small implants in the body, there is possibly the grounds for actually making you better, making you superhuman. That's what transhumanism is. And this was dubbed by one magazine as one of the world's most dangerous ideas. The problem with transhumanism is it does beg the question, why? Why do you want to run faster than human beings normally run or see beyond the visible spectrum? Is it because you want to be better? You want to outperform others? In which case, isn't that a rather pernicious journey to embark on? Surely it would be, couldn't you be more individual? Couldn't you be more creative? Couldn't you have better ideas than the other person? Not, can't you see something they can't see? And I find that rather sinister, that this rather primitive idea of one-upmanship over emphasizing the individual. And then, of course, these technologies are expensive and we'd be facing a colonialism that outpaced the old colonialism where you have the techno-haves and the techno-have-nots, which I find very sinister. So transhumanism isn't necessarily going to ensue from the screen technologies or screen culture. It's something that's there because people will always want to be special and better than other people. But it's something I think would... we can have a culture where we don't applaud it, where we do applaud individuality.
So you're especially concerned about this distinction between techno-haves and techno-haves?
Of all my worries, I think the distinction between techno-haves and have-nots is not one of my more pressing ones, because actually, in terms of the immediate digital technologies, this has actually had a huge benefit in the developing world. Mobile phones have done a lot, and one can access many, many things now on the internet that would have been very hard to have established as physical infrastructure. So I'm not so worried about that. What I'm worried about more is the mindset that creates the demand for things, rather like one wanted when one looked at Bernays in the 1920s saying, this is the torch of freedom, that you wanted to say something about yourself by having or owning something. I'm concerned that perhaps in the future people will feel so insecure that instead of putting a premium on being the wonderful individual that each of us are, they'll just want to be better than other people. And I think that would be a very sad way to go. Fantastic.
Great.
Okay. Enjoy that. So you're going to go home and take the iPads away.